From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
As lawmakers debate renaming the Gulf of Mexico, some are asking, what's in a name?
And let's instead call it the Gulf of Endor. I requested to rename I-4 to the Kessel Run.
Florida's state bird is the mockingbird, but should it be? A group of students is asking lawmakers to consider the flamingo or the scrub jay instead.
In supporting the scrub jay as the state's official songbird, I also want to address our appreciation for the American flamingo to become the state bird.
Florida officials say the American public has lost confidence in higher education. They're working to change that in the Sunshine State.
And we're ahead of the curve here in Florida because we started down that path years ago.
I'm Regan McCarthy. This is Capitol Report.
Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org. The Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com.
The Florida House passed two bills this week following the Trump administration's directive renaming the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. Tristan Wood reports the measure requires updates to maps, textbooks, and other documents.
One of the bills focuses on changing the name in state statutes, local ordinances, tax registrations, and more. The other requires the name Gulf of America to be reflected in the purchase of future school textbooks and curriculum materials. Miami Republican Representative Juan Carlos Porras sponsored one of the bills. He says the renaming has symbolic importance with the direction Trump and his party are taking the country.
We are entering a renewed age of American exceptionalism, and this bill does a significant contribution to our renewal. The new designation is much more than just a simple name change. It is a declaration that the United States is a global leader and the vanguard of democracy of the free world. With this bill, Florida will be the first state in the Union to formally codify the Gulf of America into our state textbooks, into our schools.
Democrats in the House oppose the bill. Davie Representative Michael Gottlieb says the renaming is erasing the historic context that the Gulf was named by Spanish settlers, who were instrumental to the development of the transatlantic slave trade in the Americas.
In the context of renaming the Gulf of Mexico, we must recognize that place names hold the weight of historical context. History must be taught with accuracy and integrity, not to place blame, but to ensure we understand where we have been and how we can avoid repeating our darkest moments.
Orlando Democratic Representative Anna Escamani thinks the whole renaming process is a farce.
Let's pull from one of the best franchises in American history, Star Wars, and let's instead call it the Gulf of Endor. I requested to rename I-4 to the Kessel Run. I have so many more ideas.
Palm Beach Gardens Republican Representative Meg Weinberger disagrees with Escamani. She says the proposed change is significant.
Renaming this body of water, the Gulf of America, is not a matter of name. It's a powerful step that puts America first and wholeheartedly supports President Donald J. Trump and the America First agenda.
One of the bills is already scheduled to be heard on the Senate floor next week. I'm Tristan Wood.
A group of high school and college students came to Tallahassee to advocate for their favorite bird and came away with a win. Members of the Wildlife Conservation Club at Seminole High School urged a Senate committee recently to make the Florida scrub jay the state bird. And as Margie Menzel reports, the committee's vote was unanimous.
The students call themselves the Scrub Club. They were inspired by their teacher, Chris Cole, who encouraged them to learn how to make change via the political process.
They drove 4.5 hours this morning to get here to engage in the process, and they've got another 4.5 hours home today. So we're in great hands with them.
The debate over Florida's state bird has been ongoing for decades. The current bird is the mockingbird, as it is for Mississippi, Tennessee, Texas, and Arkansas. Backers of the Florida scrub jay point out that it's endemic to the state, lives here its entire life, and is smart and friendly. The flamingo has its adherents, too. Miami Republican Senator Ileana Garcia is sponsoring a bill that would make the flamingo the state bird and the Florida scrub jay the state songbird.
In supporting the scrub jay as the state's official songbird, I also want to address our appreciation for the American flamingo to become the state bird, given its long history, vibrant appearance, and how it is native to our great state.
That's Olivia Collins, an alumna of Seminole High and the Scrub Club. She's now a sophomore at Florida State University.
Recognizing both birds allows us to celebrate Florida's diverse wildlife while honoring different aspects of its identity.
Seminole High's Abigail Tiffany says the birds are tied to the state's economy.
Most know that a bunch of Florida's GDP comes from our tourist attractions, such as Disney and Universal. To put it into perspective, Disney and Universal combined annually make, at larger estimates, around $66 billion a year. But compare that to birding, which makes $107 billion a year.
The Scrub Club has been effective. In 2022, they convinced the Seminole County Commission to make the scrub jay the official bird of Seminole County. They've gotten other high school government associations involved. They've even taken Sanford Republican Senator Jason Broder, who sits on the committee hearing the bill, to Lyonia State Preserve to see the scrub jays. In fact, Broder says, a scrub jay landed on his arm.
Yeah, I've been to the club and gone out to the facility. You guys can check my Instagram for a scrub jay landing on my arm at the park.
Scrub jays really are friendly. They're also listed as threatened under the Federal Endangered Species Act, which means the species may face extinction in the near future if its habitat continues to be destroyed. They're also protected by Florida's Endangered and Threatened Species Act and by the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act.
While it may seem not so consequential to some of the major things that we do here, it does matter to a lot of people, and it matters about in the environment, it matters about nature, and it matters about our students, and they care about it, so we should too.
Boca Raton Democratic Senator Tina Polsky has repeatedly filed bills to make the scrub jay the state bird, but she told the students she was happy to honor the flamingo as well.
I don't think we would have done it if it weren't for the advocacy of all of you. So I appreciate that. And it's kind of been going on a long time. So let's pass this bill and put this to bed, and we can move on to everything else that we need to do.
Efforts to make the scrub jay Florida's state bird have been ongoing since the 90s, but have historically met a powerful foe in former National Rifle Association President Marion Hammer. In a Palm Beach Post column, she called Florida scrub jays, quote, evil little birds that rob the nests of other birds and eat their eggs and kill their babies. I'm Margie Menzel.
On the most recent episode of the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast from the News Service of Florida, State University System Chancellor Ray Rodriguez joins Dara for a discussion on higher education. The pair delve into a panoply of changes affecting the state's public universities, such as doing away with DEI programs and services. Here's an excerpt.
The governor and you and the boards are really, I don't think it's an overstatement to say there's like an overhaul of higher education underway, right?
I would agree with that. What I would say is 2 years ago, the Gallup organization does an annual survey where they measure the confidence of the American people in a variety of institutions in the country. And 2 years ago, they included higher education. They had not done that for several years. And the results came back that only 36% of the American public had confidence in higher education. And it just shocked everybody. Because the last time they had publicized the survey that included higher education had been in 2015, and it was around 60% at that time. So it had fallen significantly from then until 2023.
Did it say why? Did they have...
In the first survey, they did not.
Okay.
But it was shocking enough that other organizations tried to recreate it.
Mm-hmm.
So the FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, actually asked the very same questions in Gallup's first one was June of 2023. FIRE did it in January 2024, and then again in May of 2024. Same exact questions that Gallup did and got the same results. They got 31% in January, 28% in May. Now, I think the May 2024 was an outlier because at the time FIRE surveyed, we had graduation going on and there were a lot of encampments, graduation ceremonies being canceled because of the protest. And I think there were a lot of negative headlines that artificially drove that number down. But the January 2024, right in line with what Gallup had.
2023. Okay.
And then FIRE was January 2024.
Okay.
And then in June 2024, Gallup did it again, but this time they were prepared. They asked why. So when the answer came back, lack of confidence in higher ed, Gallup followed that up and said, why have you lost confidence?
Yeah.
And there were three main reasons. The speculation was that the reason people had lost confidence was because of the cost and the student loan debt. That was actually number three.
Deal.
Yeah, it was a big deal. That was the third highest reason why people had lost confidence. The second highest reason was a belief that degrees were not leading to jobs. So you had everybody knew someone who had gone to college, gotten a degree, and then couldn't get a job after they graduated. And then the number one reason, which was very surprising to the media, was a belief that higher education was more about indoctrination than it was education, pushing political ideology. What I would say in, from Florida's perspective is if you go back to Senate Bill 266 in 2023, where we eliminated DEI in higher education and we removed those concepts out of general education, the state of Florida, I believe, is the only state in the country who has taken action on all three of the reasons why the American public has lost confidence in higher ed. So from your point of it being an overhaul, I would agree with that in terms of we've seen significant movement within what we're doing in general education. We've eliminated programs that now the president is requiring all universities to do mm-hmm. through executive order. And we're ahead of the curve here in Florida because we started down that path years ago.
That was State University System Chancellor Ray Rodriguez on the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast, a product of the News Service of Florida. Hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. And a bill to ban weather modification projects has passed the Florida Senate. WMNF's Chris Young reports, among other things, the bill seeks to prevent what some call chemtrails.
Senate Bill 56 would ban the release of chemicals into the air meant to affect the climate. Republican Senator Ileana Garcia sponsored the bill.
The bill doesn't ban legitimate climate research. It bans unregulated weather modification and geoengineering experiments that lack transparency and oversight. The ones that lead to the conspiracy theories, unfortunately.
The bill faced little debate and pushback on the Senate floor, except from Democratic Senator Tina Polsky.
What I don't understand is if somebody reports seeing, let's just say, for example, a chemtrail or something that they believe is a problem, by nature of what it is, it dissipates into the atmosphere. So how would DEP investigate if there was a violation of this law?
I think it's not just based on one complaint, right, or one report. I think it would be based on various.
In a video posted to social media platform X, Governor Ron DeSantis also spoke out in support of the bill. But the governor spoke out against the House version, saying they, quote, gutted the bill. The bill passed 28-9 in the Senate. I'm Chris Young.
Senate President Ben Albritton says budget differences can still be worked out as the Senate and House are more than $4 billion apart and lawmakers are getting ready to enter the final four scheduled weeks of the legislative session. The Senate and House are expected to take up their spending plans next week. After the two chambers pass their proposals, negotiations can formally start on a final plan for the fiscal year that will start July 1st. The Senate budget proposal totals more than $117 billion, while the House proposal has a nearly $113 billion spending plan. Albritton says his goal this year is to hold down spending.
We want to build a budget that's good for Floridians. We love the idea of reducing taxes. We love the idea of looking closely into the budget and find out, you know, are there places to where we could normalize the spending.
The House also wants to cut the state sales tax rate from 6% to 5.25%. Governor Ron DeSantis has said he wants to cut property taxes rather than pursuing the House plan to cut sales taxes. The legislative session is scheduled to end May 2nd. Still to come on Capitol Report. The first forecasts for Florida's upcoming hurricane season are in, but experts say regardless of the predictions, it's important to remember.
You could be in a really slow season, but that one hurricane could change your life forever.
Homeowners are still struggling with recovery after last year's busy hurricane season. For many, sifting through the process and the paperwork has proven difficult.
So yeah, it's been kind of a big emotional toll, not only going through the hurricanes, but then also having to navigate this process in particular.
And after years of advocating, a plan to help protect Wakulla Springs and its underwater cave system is moving forward.
We are all hoping to see Chip's Hole and this gas station issue put to rest in 2025.
Initial predictions for the 2025 Atlantic hurricane season have been made, and they all look rather the same. WGCU's senior environmental reporter Tom Bayless has the story.
2 months away from the official June 1st start of the Atlantic hurricane season, the number of upcoming tropical systems is usually as tough to pinpoint as the exact number of jelly beans in a glass jar. This year, it's as if everyone got a chance to count early, because the numbers are awfully alike. AccuWeather is predicting as many as 18 named tropical systems, while the newbies at Sarasota's Climate Action Center are joining the veterans at Colorado State University and forecasting 17 named storms. A difference of one is also all that separates the three groups' predictions of whether four or five storms will turn into major hurricanes. Those are the three most destructive, which start with sustained winds of at least 111 miles per hour and rise to as fast as 215 miles per hour recorded in Hurricane Patricia in the Pacific Ocean a decade ago. Each agency is also forecasting the upcoming hurricane season to be above normal. Levi Silvers, a research scientist with the vaunted Colorado State University team, said above normal leaves a lot of wiggle room.
So the temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico and the main development region at the surface of the ocean are warmer than normal, but fortunately they're less than they were last year. So we hope that there will be less activity than last year, but they are still above normal. And one way to think about that does not ensure rapid intensification, but it kind of loads the dice.
The one thing meteorologists are split on this year is whether summer will see a La Nina pattern, which can foster storm growth, or an El Nino, which can hamper hurricane intensity, or a state of neutrality. Either way, Silvers from Colorado State said it only takes one hurricane on our doorstep to make the season a disaster.
You could be in a really slow season, but that one hurricane could change your life forever. Southwest Florida residents, I think, really always need to be vigilant and aware. We know there's an elevated probability of landfall relative to a normal season, but we just don't know what's going to happen exactly.
And that's the current conventional wisdom within the hurricane forecasting community. At least until May or June, when everyone updates their predictions as hurricane season gets underway. In Southwest Florida, I'm Tom Bayless.
More than 10,000 people in the Tampa Bay area who were slammed by last year's hurricanes have received letters saying they have to either rebuild their homes or raise them above flood stage. But many of them didn't even have anyone inspect the insides of their homes. WUSF's Steve Newborn talks with the Tampa Bay Times reporters who broke the story, Colby Edmonds and Tegan Simonton.
So you guys have written, their struggle hinges on a single piece of paper that often comes with no explanation for how the determination was made. And the real interesting part about this is you reported Florida law doesn't require a claims adjuster to even enter a home during a damage assessment. So they're just looking at a watermark outside the home, and which shows basically how high the storm surge went.
Yeah, I think Tegan can talk a little bit about the mathematic calculations behind it, but it is essentially assessors looking at the outside of homes to see the watermark and then using a FEMA calculator, FEMA estimation to determine how much water went inside. But residents who I spoke to kind of disagreed with that approach because it doesn't always, in their experience, lead to an accurate calculation of how much water actually went inside of their house.
Tegan, you've written that Pinellas County and Hillsborough County are both using private contractors here. Do they follow any kind of rules? Are they trained? And what do they base their rulings on?
So reporting of this is ongoing. What we've found is that counties really have a certain level of discretion in determining how substantial damage is calculated. They can determine how they come about the damage estimation and how they come about the structure value for each given home, which is kind of the two parts of the fraction that make up a damage percentage. That being said, the level of damage with these storms was so great that a lot of local governments needed some extra help.
So I'd imagine that this is targeting primarily people who live along the Pinellas beaches.
Colby?
I mean, what are you hearing from the homeowners there about all this?
Something that most people reiterated to me was that it's so devastating to go through a hurricane and, you know, lose all of your belongings and lose your home. And then this process, they've said, has been very difficult. Just, you know, navigating hurricane recovery bureaucracy can be very difficult for people just generally. And the substantial damage assessment process was new for a lot of people, and most people haven't experienced this process specifically. So yeah, it's been kind of a big emotional toll, not only going through the hurricanes, but then also having to navigate this process in particular and, you know, receiving a letter. And people have told me that they read that as, I'm losing my home, I'm losing everything.
Are you hearing a lot of people saying this is grossly unfair? Nobody came inside my home and actually looked inside to see what kind of damage there was?
Yeah, I mean, the reason that I even started reporting on this, I was at a Pinellas County Commissioners meeting in December, and during public comment, that is what several residents brought up, is that you're telling me I have to tear down my home and no one went inside. And so that's been a big issue for a lot of folks. And what we tried to do with this story is really explain that for readers and explain for residents throughout the area, why is this the process and why is this happening?
Are you getting comments from people like they're just throwing up their hands and saying, I'm going to have to sell my property because of the cost?
Yeah, I think some people are kind of feel discouraged by it, feel frustrated by it. And I've heard this anecdotally through people who I've talked to, but just kind of feel resigned about, you know, I don't want to go through this. And then my home might get hit by another hurricane next year. So I think there's a few layers to people feeling frustrated with the situation.
Tegan, what have you been hearing out there from people?
You know, one thing that I also want to add is that local governments have told us that in a lot of cases, these letters are sort of like the first step. A homeowner gets them and then they have the opportunity to appeal. But for a lot of people, then the onus is on them to hire a private appraiser, to hire a contractor, to kind of try to contradict these numbers or this damage percentage. And a lot of people either maybe don't have the time or they don't have the ability to do that at this time because of everything that you mentioned. This was an extremely difficult emotional and financial event for a lot of folks.
We've been talking with Colby Edmonds and Tegan Simonton, reporters with the Tampa Bay Times. Thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Regan McCarthy. Finally this week, a major chapter in Florida's efforts to protect an underwater cave system that connects to Wakulla Springs may be coming to a close. Adrian Andrews reports a new trade agreement between a statewide land trust and a Georgia oil company could save the cave from potential pollutants.
Hidden deep underneath Wakulla's surface lies the largest underwater cave system in Florida and in the United States. Wakulla Springs' caves stretch beyond 45 miles with tunnels connecting to at least 30 different openings, one being Chip's Hole, In 1987, a group of U.S. divers explored the cave to see what was inside. They captured the footage all on camera, spotting freshwater life and swimming through deep, dark tunnels. Before 1987, only a couple of teams had explored the springs and its caves, but Christopher Werner, the science director for the Woodville Karst Plain Project, explains no one has explored the entire Wakulla cave system. He points to the cave's massive tunnels and the special equipment needed to survive the exploration.
If sea level was lower than it is right now, and people could visit this cave and look, you know, and kind of see how big this was, it would be a national park. It's just the fact that not many people can visit it, for one, and two, that it's underwater. You know, this isn't your normal kind of recreational scuba diving.
Warner's team began exploring Wakulla's caves in the early 90s. They're credited for making the discovery that revealed the connection between Chip's Hole and Wakulla Springs. Their findings caused residents and state officials to want to protect the cave.
Wakulla Springs is a huge economic driver for this entire part of Florida.
Renee Murray is with the group Friends of Wakulla Springs. Murray, since 2022, has urged the county to block a Georgia-based oil company from building a gas station on their land that sits on top of Chip's Hole Cave. She worries any spilled gas may contaminate the spring and its caves. She says people should think about the springs as more than just a body of water.
It is a world-renowned spring. People come from all over the world to see it. That's why people should care.
Florida lawmakers stepped in last year, sending $3 million to Conservation Florida for them to buy land in Wakulla County to swap with the Georgia Oil Company. Tracy Dean is the CEO of the Land Trust. She says the group has spoken with the oil company and is prepared to move forward with the trade.
We've negotiated that with Southwest Georgia Oil. They have been, you know, very willing participant in all of these conversations.
Dean says Conservation Florida will trade 7 of the 200 acres it acquired last December. The rest of the space will be protected, and the proposed location for Wakulla's gas station will be relocated to property away from Chip's Hole Cave.
We are all hoping to see Chip's Hole and this gas station issue put to rest in 2025 and add some really good conservation to the region, all while providing a gas station for a growing population.
Conservation Florida expects to have the trade completed by December. I'm Adrian Andrews.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Gina Jordan, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Derek Hamm, Chris Young, Steve Newborn, and Tom Bayless. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Regan McCarthy. Join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org. The Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.